sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets rally. The key index is showing an overheated situation. Twitter plunges after a big ride. Social media stocks follow along. And as the end of the year draws very near, there's some ideas for 2014. That's right. We have a guest, Frank Curzio, your favorite, coming on today, as well as Ken Shea from Bloomberg Industries. We're going to talk about e-cigarettes and the tobacco industry. All this and much more on episode number 345 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, it's almost a brand new year. We're on the final episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast for the year 2013. And we have done quite a ride. Haven't we seen quite a ride from the beginning of the year to where we are now? And it seems like it's never going to end. But we do see a lot of things that are showing us some contrary signals, which we're going to talk about, and we do have some great guests. First, I want to say thank you so much for being here this year with me. The friendship that you've provided, even though it is a little bit one-sided at some times, where I'm just talking about whatever we're going through, bringing on the guests, and we're talking here, and you're listening in. But I got to tell you, you are here. You are with us every step of the way, of course, through your emails, through your comments. And I feel you all the time being there. So thanks so much for sharing the year with me. And I do wish you and your family a wonderful and a happy holiday and a very, very healthy, happy, and prosperous new year. So with that, I'll also mention that if you do want to and you haven't done so in the past, you could always send me a note at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I read every single one of them, and I respond to every single one of them, at least the ones that have a request for a response. So just write to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So we came a long way this year, where it looked like there was so many different roadblocks, so many different headwinds that were occurring from the sequester and the budget issues and the healthcare. Now we're coming into the next issue about the budget and the potential for the discontinuance of unemployment benefits, which will, in fact, run out at the stroke of midnight on New Year's Day or December 31st. And it's going to cause a problem for over, I don't know, 1.5 million people that will be no longer getting their unemployment, the extended emergency benefits that they were getting for the last 99 weeks or so. Now, what does that mean? It should have some kind of effect on retail. At least you should see that the concern would be that retail will slow down, particularly in the areas of, we'll call it the low to mid-range retailers. The high-end retailers have a little bit of a different situation going on here, but you know, with the Walmarts and Targets and maybe your apparel companies, maybe some of the staples in certain areas, as well as the, again, the mid-range, maybe the dollar stores, you have seen them starting to pull back, Family Dollar stores, and, for example, Five Below has not been doing very well lately. And that's probably due to the fact that the realization is that moving forward, there's not going to be a renewal. There's nothing that's been said that there'll be a renewal. You don't know with our government these days that they may pull a rabbit out of their hat at the last minute and something will happen and you'll get amazing 11th, hour 59-minute renewal of the health, well, that's another issue we'll talk about, the healthcare, but the unemployment benefits that are going to run out. I don't know how that's going to play out, I'll be honest with you, because you can look at all the numbers that we've seen this year, whether it's the fact that we're going to have a taper and what should probably happen because of that, and if the sequester went through and what should happen because of that, and if the budget issue and the government shut down, and what would happen because of that, and the fact that wage growth has been slowing, and we can go on, and try to give some reality check to the situation that's occurring, but the markets don't seem to really care right now. Why is that? Well, it's because that the U.S. market is probably one of the better places to be compared to many places around the world. You see that Europe is still having a lot of trouble. They're still having trouble with their banks, even though their markets have risen very nicely. Germany continues to expand very nicely. We saw some contraction in a few of the countries. But yet, at the same time, there's a lot of concern about the emerging markets, as we talked about with Das last week, and the fact that how long is the honeymoon going to last with Shinzo Abe in Japan with the amount of money printing that's going on there. So when you look at the fact that the strongest country in the world is still U.S., and we're seeing that the dollar has come down a bit, and the fact that you're seeing that we are showing better growth, that amazing number of GDP over 3%. Who knows where we're going next? Could be quite amazing to see a very large jump in GDP. I'd be surprised. I think there was a little bit of an aberration in the last number when it came to inventories, as I've talked about, not to bore you on that, but that's going to be a major issue. And we're going to have to see how that plays out. One of the big things and big themes that we have been looking at is the expansion of the e-cigarette, electronic cigarettes in the tobacco area, because this is something that has been really starting to percolate a bit under the surface. We're seeing that many companies in the tobacco area, of course, were under fire for many years, not being allowed to smoke in restaurants and public places, and the education of the young folks out there about how bad tobacco and smoking is, from the carbons that are ingested and inhaled to the nicotine and all the problems with it. Well, now you have all of a sudden a new cigarette alternative that may actually negate a lot of the teachings that have gone on, a lot of the education that's gone on, because there's a few things. Number one, the potential to have a cigarette without nicotine and without the carbon intake that you'll get. Very interesting. Now, I'm not saying this personally per se. I'm saying this, that you may see a change of the social acceptance level of this. So we're going to bring on someone who knows a lot about that, and that's Kenneth Shea in a bit. We'll talk to him. I have some questions. There's a couple of companies that I think are very interesting to take a look at, and there's only a few companies that are actually traded publicly that are still available to buy that are pure plays on the electronic cigarette craze that's going on. There's been many companies that have been bought out already, but we'll get into that discussion with him in a moment. But first we'll talk to Frank Curzio, and then we got lots of stuff planned for today and lots of good discussions I think we're going to have, because of course Frank Curzio and I could just talk for 10 shows without a break. He's great. The other things I want to talk about are, you know, the year end, what's happening. We have a very shortened period that is going to be coming. We've had that Santa Claus rally that was sparked by the Fed only pulling back about $10 billion in the bond buying. But what we've seen recently, because of the move that we just had, is that the key reversal indicator, which is something that is pretty good at defining bottoms and tops and when there's an overbought or an oversold situation, we call it overheating or oversold, is peaking out. We've seen some clusters form, which are when we have readings of over a 4 or a 5, and we start getting the average reading much higher than about 4 or so. And we've had the last several days reaching 4, 5, and then now it Friday was back to a 3. But still, when you see those clusters forming, oftentimes if you look at a chart and you can see exactly where it lays out, if you're looking at it, you'll see that there is usually a reversal that's relatively imminent. You'll see that markets need to cool off a little while. Now, maybe some of the excess heat that was seen in companies like Twitter and Facebook and Tesla over the last several days, which really ramped up, and we saw some of that taken back on Friday, where social media stocks were just getting, you know, pummeled. Twitter was down 13%, the biggest one day since its IPO and public offering release on the markets. And of course, that's because we did get one downgrade with a price target of 46, and this thing is shooting up 8% a day for the last several days. So it did have to cool. But the bigger question is, are the markets themselves overheated in a way that we need to see a drawdown? Now, it would seem that from the run that we've had to the end of the year, with the ability to take some profits this year, offset them with maybe some losses, et cetera, from previous years, you may see some selling. Now, there's only a couple of days left, but the potential is very high for, at least in the next week or so, for this reversal to occur. Now, we did post that on, I think we posted that on Twitter over the weekend, and I will put up a quick chart of what it looks like historically and what you can see. I'll put some arrows on it so you can see that in the Monday edition of the DisciplinedInvestor.com. Now, I also mentioned to you before we get to our guests that you have to be aware that, well, if you're looking for some trading signals, some alerts, a subscription service that gives you buy and sell suggestions based on some pretty good statistics and some very good algorithms, you can get a 14-day free trial to Trigger Point Research Alerts. Now, one of the things that we're going to introduce for 2014 that we've been working on diligently is a very simple, we'll call it market timing subscription model, where it's just one security, for example, it's maybe the SPY, the S&P 500, where you're in or you're out. Now, we've done a lot of work on this utilizing a couple of different indicators and algorithms, and so far what we're finding is that it has a very good success ratio from a swing trade situation. That may be, we've seen over the last 20 years about, as low as maybe 8 or 9 transactions short and long per year, and as many as maybe 30 in any given year. So it's really not a situation when you're in, out, but it is a swing trade, and we're looking for some very significant lows to be buying into and some very significant highs to short and move out of. And if you look at the chart, and we're going to have this for you soon, so just be patient, you'll see that this hits it very well. We've created an indicator that will actually do this and then provide the signal to you through email and text. So just stick around for that one. If you're not on the mailing list to find out more about that, go over to Trigger Point Research and just sign up for the mailing list. And when that comes out, you'll get first information about that. Really interesting indicator and algorithm that we've created. We've been working on this for a while. Other than that, I think it's probably a good idea to get to our guests because we do have some very good guests to talk to today. I'll also mention at the end of the show, there is probably the best rendition of Auld Lang Syne, or whatever you pronounce that, the New Year's Eve song that everybody sings and nobody seems to know the words, including myself. But I mumble along and sing that one phrase when it comes along and looks like I guess I know what I'm singing. But I have a great, great edition of that I picked up that I think you should listen to and just kind of close the year with a nice note and go from there. So let's get it on. And for the year-end show, who else would we have but Frank Curzio, of course, a good friend of the show and a good friend of mine, good friend of yours. Everybody loves him. From Stansberry Research, he is a wonderful writer and research analyst. And man, you've been on some TV lately, huh?
Yeah, you know, we're trying to strengthen our media appearance at Stansberry, and it's pretty cool. But some guys are really good on TV, and some guys really don't like it. So out of all of our analysts, they're pretty much calling me. And not that I like it or not, but you know how it is. Some guys are really good on TV. Some guys would rather just write. And, you know, we're supposed to have this big media presence, and they're like, Frank, here you go. It's all you. I'm like, what are you talking about? So it's not because I'm smart. It's not because I'm good looking. Believe me, when you see me, you wonder why you know why I do a podcast. But it's just like, you know, they've been calling lately, which is pretty cool.
You're a good looking guy. I don't know what you're talking about. You're a good looking guy. You're a good looking guy. You are. So listen, let's talk about, you know, the things that you were on. You were on recently, on, I think it was ABC, for the review of the Fed meeting, right?
Yeah, I was talking live during the analysis. Think about CNBC, they had that panel on there as they're talking about what's going to happen. Then they said tapering, and then you have the speech. Like, I was on live, except it was ABC, not CNBC, ABC News. And, the tapering came, and, you know, I got a couple of emails a half an hour before saying, Frank, you know, they're going to taper. I'm hearing they're going to taper. I mean, the rumors broke out. Something got leaked. So the tapering was a tiny bit of a surprise. We all knew it was going to happen, right? Tapering is they're reducing their bond buying program. That's QE3, basically, in effort to keep interest rates low. They were either going to do it now or they were going to do it in January, February. You know, it wasn't too much of a big deal. The bigger deal was the Fed basically said, and this is why during Ben Bernanke's speech, the market went up another 100 points. They said, you know what? Unemployment, we don't even care about it.
Mm-hmm.
We're not even going to look at unemployment anymore. Total change, right? It's like if it's at 7%, they said if it goes to 6.5%, we'll think about tightening, right? And remember, unemployment was 9, 8.5, 8, went down to 6. Now it's coming down so fast. They're like, you know what? We're not even going to look at the unemployment rate. What's more important to us is we're going to look at the inflation rate, which is a CPI. So if as long as it stays under 2%, we're going to have a low interest rate policy. Well, if you look at the Fed's numbers, you know when they expect it to go over 2%?
Yeah, it's in like 2075 or something.
Close. 2017.
Yeah.
Just 4 years from now. So it's almost like, you know, if I can provide an analogy, it's almost like if someone can't walk, you have the two best runners in the world that are going to carry you for 3 straight years, you know what I mean? So you're always going to be in the race. And long story short here, stocks are going to be the best investment over the next 3 years. I don't like the fact that the Fed's in this. I don't like, people might not like it, they might be in the sidelines, but the bottom line is almost every single pullback, and we'll get a pullback because we had such an amazing year, up 25%, 27%, whatever, up 35% in small caps. We're going to get that pullback, but that pullback is going to be met by a buying opportunity because, you know, where else are you going to put your money in a low interest rate environment, especially a low interest rate environment, which we believed, right, Andrew, in 2009, 2010, we definitely see inflation right now. We think, you know, all right, this is just temporary, right? We had the credit crisis. We never knew it was going to be 6, 7, 8 years of quantitative easing in the market. No analyst predicted. Nobody predicted. Nobody. Everybody would tell you they predicted. Nobody predicted that at this time. If you looked at 2009, that they would see no inflation right now based on what they look at, the consumer price index. So, you know, it's telling you that stocks are going to remain a great investment. You don't want to invest in bonds. You really don't want to invest in, you know, you keep your money in treasuries and cash, earn negative returns after inflation. You know, people are going to buy these stocks, I think, over the next couple of years. It was just amazing to me that they said that.
Right. And not only that, if you take away the fact that they also said, by the way, just to kind of give you, I think, a further point here is that if, in fact, they do see the economic numbers that will show them something other than the fact that things are getting better, they could always add back. You know, so they gave you all the reasons to say that they are being extraordinarily dovish. I think also the way they did it, there was a lot of there was other things behind the scenes that were going on. I think that Bernanke wanted to go out on a good note and not ever be liable for the fact that 10 years down the road, let's say, if inflation just went berserk and things went crazy, that he was not willing to cut back. So therefore, just this little move, this $10 billion cutback, was at least a sign of showing that, okay, you know, willing to be flexible. And then whatever happens from there, you know, it's out of his hands at this point. He already started. If it is going to be an economy that moves forward very nicely, hey, that's great. At the same time, you know, it's interesting. The bonds have been, since then, the bonds have been being sold off. I think the 10-year hit 3% this week. And, you know, what's interesting, I find, is that when you look at the stocks, when you see that the P.E. ratio of the S&P is 17, and a lot of discussion that you're seeing is all about P.E. expansion, which means that there's going to be potentially a leveling off of, let's call it EPS and earnings per share, but people are more willing to buy stocks, and they're willing to buy it on the idea that the earnings will grow into the overall valuation sometime. But when you look at some of this, I mean, there's a lot of stocks right now that are, by most standards, quote-unquote, overvalued, but yet they're still being bought.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this before we even came on, like Twitter. Twitter is trading at 40 times next year's sales. What are they supposed to generate? Like $1.5 billion. And it's over $40 billion market cap, I believe. And to put that in perspective for investors and what that means, if Google is trading at 40 times sales, it would be over $6,000. It's $1,100 today. I mean, just to put it in perspective. But more important, I want investors to understand this, because when you look at a P.E. ratio, you can't take a P.E. ratio on a standalone basis. For example, if you're buying a company that has a 25 P.E., everything relative, you're going to say, wow, that's really expensive because the market's trading at whatever, 16, 17 times earnings. Yet, they may be growing a lot faster than that, which makes it not as expensive. Maybe they're growing earnings 40, 50%. Now, when you're looking at the earnings multiple of 17, people have to realize that 17 may look expensive, but if you're going back historically, if you're looking at this type of environment, and you're looking at GDP growth going to be more than 3% over the next couple of years, you could bet anything amount of money, it's definitely going to be more than 3% next couple of years with the amount of stimulus. And I'll explain that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But you're also looking at interest rates being forced to stay at low levels. That makes a 17 PE kind of cheap. And again, this is a totally different. People listen to my podcast. I'm doing a pullback. This is totally different from what I thought 2 months ago, especially 1 month ago when I saw what the Fed just did, a couple weeks ago what the Fed just did. And said, look, we don't care about unemployment. We're looking at inflation. And basically, inflation is going to be tame for another 3 years. So if you're looking at the multiple, don't say, well, 17 times is normally expensive. It's not really expensive. You can look at the multiple, go to 20, 21 times earnings. If we get more than 3% growth and the Fed's forcing, keeping interest rates at a very low level, 17 is going to be considered cheap. So you have to look at the PE that way, I believe. And, you know, one more quick point here. You're looking at the Fed, and this is what's so surprising to me and why I did a complete 180 is the Fed actually said these words. They said that, you know, we're still seeing, you know, we're far away from seeing this market come back. And I was so surprised that Ben Bernanke said, he said something to that knowledge. I don't have the exact quote, but, you know, we still have, you know, we're far away. Well, if you look at the latest statistics that are out, household wealth was $73 trillion. That's an all-time record since mm-hmm. America was founded.
Right.
Yep. Americans are more richer today than they've ever been in the history of America, right? You have. Did you see Ford Motor? Ford Motor came out and said, we're going to have our best year in history. Yep. The company's 110 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Manufacturing at five-year high. You have unemployment rate coming down. You're looking at housing. I mean, clearly recovering and going higher and higher. Look at the housing stocks even doing well. We're looking at five-year highs. I just can't believe that the Fed, in their mind, is saying that we need to keep this going for another 3 years while we're seeing the results of this. I don't care who you are. The people who say that that QE didn't work are people who haven't been in this market. Because you tell me household wealth is at an all-time record high. People are more rich today than they were in 2007 and 1999, 2002. It's pretty remarkable that the Fed's like, well, you know, we really don't care. We're still far away from where we want to be. That's surprising to me.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing in terms of I think the people that say that QE didn't work, I think that they're hanging their hat on the fact that maybe certain asset prices, ex the stock market, didn't move up, or maybe that unemployment didn't move up fast enough, or maybe I don't know. You know, they can pull out a variety of different things on one-offs and say, hey, you know, maybe that wasn't worthwhile. Or even, you know, the amount of QE that was involved for the trade-off, you know, to see that we're finally getting a decent GDP print, but how long did it take with how much money? I think that they can point to that, or they have been pointing to that. But I agree with you. The other thing is that bonds, you know, you see that bonds are creeping up, they're being sold. There was a theory out, I don't know, you know, last year, let's say, that said if interest rates started going up and because bonds are being sold, we're going to see this great rotation from bonds into stocks. And, well, I believe that to be that, you know, a good case that could be made for that. You know, there's still those incremental bond buyers who have to be in bonds at a certain level for whatever reason, whether it's a pension plan, whether it's individuals that don't want the risk, et cetera. Some of them, yes, being pushed into risk, and I can see that. But at the same time, you know, there is this whole rotation going on and money's coming from somewhere. And I think it's also coming from ex-US that's being put into stocks. And when you see some of the moves that you've seen lately on particular issues, whether it's, you know, we can focus on Twitter, Facebook, Tesla, you know, where they were kind of like, you know, falling off a little bit. And then all of a sudden they have these monstrous runs. I think that that points to some of the catch up that's trying to be done. I do agree with you that the potential sell-offs will be met with buying. You know, it all depends on what level we're dealing with here. But what's really fascinating, I think, in all of this, Frank, is that, and maybe it's because of the Fed, really, I mean, really, that's the only thing, that you can't even get a 3% correction in this market to last more than a week and a half.
Yeah, it is pretty crazy. And I don't know how much money is actually going to come in from the bond market. I mean, you know, we hear that argument a lot. I don't know if it's actually going to happen. And there's people who would never, ever come into the stock market no matter what. And right. That's funds, including individuals' funds. It's just, you know, for a 65-year-old and older, that you don't want that. I mean, you'd rather underperform the market than have a chance to risk a crash with stocks. People are just scared of stocks. But I think you will see a lot of money come into like Dow components. You're going to see, I mean, if you buy the Dow or if you buy the S&P 500, you know, it's yielding about 1.8%, I believe. Hey, you could earn 2% and buy these companies that, I mean, look at their balance sheets now. It's just incredible how big their balance. They restructured all their debt at lower interest rates, the companies that had debt. Now they're sitting on massive amounts of cash they could do whatever they want with. They're still not spending it yet. So, you know, we'll go into that and what we expect for next year. I think a lot of cash will be spent. It's going to be, you know, dividends, buybacks, and definitely acquisitions of smaller companies. I mean, these companies have to grow, and they're having trouble growing their top line. So, you know, they might just take the position of an Oracle and say, look, Oracle became one of the biggest companies in the world by acquiring all these. If you're good at acquiring companies like a private equity firm, like a KKR, it's an amazing, amazing strategy. People are so against it. Well, you know, you're not growing organically. Listen, who cares? Look at what happened to Oracle. I mean, people bought Oracle 15 years ago. You're a millionaire, you know? So if you know how to actually integrate these companies into one, it's a fantastic business with companies like KKR could do all the time. But I think you're going to see a lot of that cash go into because they have to meet their numbers. It's going to be a little more difficult. I mean, it's going to be a lot easier with lower interest rates and people more wealthy than they've ever been in the history of this country. So they'll definitely spend more. But it's going to be interesting going into next year where, like you said, we haven't seen a 3% correction. We're definitely going to see a correction next year. I just think it's going to be met with a buying opportunity. And you have to be selective with your stocks. I mean, you could see Twitter fall 30% from here wouldn't be a big deal. We saw almost a 50% correction in Tesla, and look where it is now. It's back up to 155. So you're seeing these stocks jump all over the place, and people are waiting for those corrections to jump in and buy. Not that I'd say buy Tesla or Twitter, but you know, it's just I think if you put a lot of names on a list and buying 15-20% down, you'll probably see that correction. I would think before March.
Well, you know, and the other thing is that you mentioned the acquisitions. One of the things that you could see how acquisitions, and this is a general comment, but a lot of the acquisitions that you see these days have the acquiring company actually moving up after the purchase. Now, for a long time, I mean forever, it was always that, okay, very simple math. You have the company that's buying, you know, company A that's buying company B. Company B stock obviously meets to the price level that the purchase price is going to be, and company A usually, you know, falls a little bit for a few days, and you know, the outlay of the cash and the outlay of this and the unknown and all that, you know, usually the stock takes a little bit of a dip. These days, you're seeing that when there is an acquisition, particularly if one is obviously accretive very quickly, the acquiring company moves up dramatically. It's kind of a fascinating change of what you usually would see.
You brought up a good point there. I think it matters from deal to deal. We have seen it because it's a bull market and everything goes up no matter what. But accretive is a big word there. That means that they're going to make money off of that acquisition. And they usually say it during their acquisition. They say, listen, we're acquiring this company. We expect it to be accretive to earnings. Within, you know, if they say within 6 months or less than a year, that's a really good sign. That means they're buying a company cheap. That usually would mean. I mean, people would say, well, look how much you're paying for it. But if they're expecting to generate earnings for themselves off of this company after they combine the company, that's really a good sign. And sometimes you'll see both. And it depends on the acquisition. I mean, if it's really the synergies are met, they're going to be able to cut costs. Of course, that means firing a lot of people because the businesses are overlapping. That's a really good sign. But it is interesting because I have seen that lately. And again, it's a bull market. But not with every single deal. But when companies are able to purchase other companies, you usually see the person who's acquiring go down because, you know, they're spending money or issuing stock. And, of course, you know, they have to pay a 30% premium for whatever company they're going to buy around. And then you can see that company go up. But you're right, because usually the acquirer goes down. But both of them have been going up in this bull market.
Mm-hmm. And let's kind of shift over to some of the commodities. I think that's really interesting that we've seen the movement that we've seen. I mean, we see that oil has been moving very nicely higher. And there was just a very bizarre inventory shift over the last, I guess, month and a half or so. And then you had things with the Keystone Pipeline and all that. But gold has been hovering around this, we'll say the $1,200 level. And some of that, you know, you see when there's better growth numbers that are provided that there's a concern. The dollar did move up for a while, then started moving down. And, you know, there's a lot of people on the short side of gold, so you're going to see these quick pops. Gold stocks, you and I have talked about many, many times, they're on the kind of the edge of problems, you know, depending on the exact level of the price of gold. Many of them can't make any money. They're shutting down. They're slowing down production, which is good and bad because, you know, you put more on there. There's also a lot of interest being talked about, this whole area of the selling that's going on in the ETFs. That was my main issue with gold some time ago, was that, you know, there's so much invested in the commodity that's being held by these ETFs that you start seeing the selling, and all of a sudden you have a lot more of this gold that has to be the physical that needs to be put back on the market, you may see a lot of downside, you know, moving with gold. Has gold leveled off here?
That's a good question. I mean, I've been negative on gold the entire year and been very, very selective where I do buy prices, where you could buy gold stocks trading near cash. I'm talking about either junior miners or some of even the big guys now that have gotten killed. The reason is, you know, we're fortunate to have a lot of people that we talk to in this industry have been around for 30, 40 years. Guys like Rick Rule, who's been basically financing companies for 40 years. The all-in cash cost, in other words, to produce an ounce of gold, how much cash does it cost, it is $1,300 for a lot of these companies. Now, you're talking about gold is $1,200, dip below $1,200. That means these companies cannot make money producing the only thing that they can produce. And we all know how maybe they could produce byproducts of gold. But we all know that you know, with gold prices and where they are and where they're coming down, it's going to hurt gold stocks. The fact that they can't make money right now is really scary. I mean, it's a great market for the large guys who are definitely going to survive. I mean, these guys, if you look at the overcapacity and how much they bought property for over the last 5 years, guys, just Google it. Unbelievable. Like hundreds of billions of dollars. All of it's going to be completely written off pretty soon. But if you're looking right now, and let's talk about right now, okay, not the past, and this is someone who's been negative on the market. If you're looking at valuations, they're comparing to 2008, 2009. And the last time I saw gold stocks, even companies like Yamana Gold, which is a mid-tier producer, the last time I saw valuations like this was back then, and you saw 100 to 200% gains in these stocks, even more. Some of them went up 500, 600%, and we were fortunate to buy some of those stocks that went up 500% in my newsletter. And right now, we're seeing the same valuations. It doesn't mean go out and buy gold right now. You want to see some sort of catalyst. Big deal, you missed the 15 or 20% run-up. I mean, these things are down 75, 80, 90%. Right. It doesn't matter. Right. But you want to see some kind of catalyst in there that says, okay, gold is finally bottom. So in short, I'm looking at gold stocks right now. I'm not buying. I'm still negative. It's in a downtrend. I feel like you're trying to catch a falling knife here. But guys, these are stocks where if you could buy them near cash, okay, you look at the cash on a balance sheet. A lot of these companies don't have any debt on their balance sheet. They just have cash. If they come down to cash or even below cash, it's almost like buying a bank well below book value. If you did that strategy, you used that strategy in 2009, 2010, you made a lot of money on banks. So you're buying these companies below book value, near cash, keep an eye on them. You know, if they're trading below their cash value, they're good investments, and that's what they're coming down to. So definitely keep an eye on it because, you know how it is with an industry where it's so negative, Andrew, you know, being in this market for 30 years, when these things turn.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot of fun. So yeah. And you want to buy what everybody hates gold right now.
Right.
So just keep your eye on it. It's a good place to make returns, but limit yourself through stop losses. Maybe that's a 15% loss, a 5% loss. Not even, don't do it at 5% loss because you could get stopped out in a day in gold in some of these gold stocks. But just, you know, BK, I think gold does come down. It's going to create a tremendous opportunity. I'm looking at the sector right now. I have a lot of names I'd like to buy, but I'm holding off right now.
So let's talk about 2014. You know, a lot of times there is this rotation that goes on, and you can track back, you know, year in and year out, that oftentimes, yeah, you may see the leading sector perform and outperform every other sector, maybe, you know, sometimes for 2 years in a row. It's very possible. You know, you see things that happen back in the early 2000s when technology was obviously the leader. You saw this, you know, they were just the top of the board for a few years. But there is usually some kind of a rotation that goes on. You could see it would happen with the banks over the last year and a half or so. The builders, for example, you know, they were at the bottom of the barrel for a while, and then they start all of a sudden moving. And it's not only because that, okay, they were at the bottom, now they're moving to the top, because a lot of times what happens is these companies have put in some kind of change to what they're doing in their overall, management, and it takes a little while to come to fruition. And when it does, it can really pop, especially if there's a recovering in that sector. So, you know, this year, you know, you're seeing a lot of the technology still doing well. Consumer discretionary has been on fire. Staples has been okay. You know, you're seeing the big mega caps obviously do very well. You're also seeing the industrials do quite well. Materials have been back and forth a bit. What do you see as a trend, if there is such a thing, that maybe plays out next year?
I think technology is going to have a monster year. It's underperformed the market, probably around 10 to 12%. But I like small cap technology, like individual players, if you want some. I like a company that just got nailed. Also, another. Actually, I'll give away one of the companies that I like in fingerprint technology. It's called Aware. that I really like going forward. I think, fingerprint technology and all new iPhones, I think it's going to be the standard technology. It's almost impossible to steal anything from you unless you cut some guy's finger off.
Right.
So everything's going to be on there with credit card, your license, everything's going to be on there. It's almost like you eliminate all that need for security through your fingerprint identification. I think that's going to be a massive trend. Also, cloud computing is going to be very, very big. A lot of those companies are a little bit expensive now. But you know, in terms of big data, I love that trend as well, where companies analyze data, all this free data. Like, for instance, like Facebook, you know, people post everything, their entire lives, where they went to school, what they like, where they are. I'm checking in now. You know, all that data gets analyzed by these algorithms, and it basically spits out stuff where if you're in Starbucks, you're going to get a text message saying, hey, get $5 off if you buy this. You're like, wow, I'm in Starbucks. How'd that happen?
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty crazy, but they're almost able to predict what you're going to do and when you're going to do it because you provide so much free information. You don't even know on Twitter and what you tweet and what you like. One company I like that's gotten hit that I'd buy right now is Tibco Software, run by a billionaire, Vive Vendive, who's an owner, I believe, of Sacramento Kings now, but he's in his own basketball teams, great guy, and he really took the helm of this company because it's been doing so poor. So if you look at the chart, you're going to be like, wow, this company really underperformed. They just missed the quarter and came down. We've bought it around these levels, and we were up a little bit more, but it came down to the level where we bought it. But I really like this as a big data play. I think it can get taken over. They're restructuring their business from doing a ton of small deals to only big deals, and they've done more record deals than they've ever done. But it's a big data play that I like. And with the amount of cash on these companies like Microsoft, Google, even Facebook, the amount of cash on these balance sheets, I think, and these companies having trouble growing their top line, you're going to see a lot of acquisitions in the technology space, which has underperformed the market right now. So a good call is coming up. I'm going to be attending is a Consumer Electronics Show. It's in the first week or between first, second week of January. I think you're going to see the latest trends come out. And I think you're going to see a lot of buzz on technology this year and a lot of acquisitions in that space. These guys have a ton of cash. You have a lot of guys like Icon taking positions at Apple saying, look, you got to do something with the cash. Give it back to shareholders. Buy back stock. Increase your dividend, which, you know, is okay for some of these large cap stocks, but they have so much cash, I think it pays to buy some of these smaller names. And, you know, you're starting to see that trend happen, especially with 3D, that whole technology. I mean, 3D Systems purchased, I think, 9 companies in the past 9 months or something.
Yeah, no, they've been great. I mean, we've held them through a lot of the thick and thin and actually just took them down off a beautiful profit recently as they kind of peaked out. And there was some selling that went on, pretty substantial selling. But yeah, the 3D concept where you have companies like not only the small companies that are using it for replication parts and things, but now some of the bigger companies that are using that. I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, it's a little bit pricey right now. But then again, you know, what are you comparing it to? There's only a few companies in the sector. And if these guys miss any kind of numbers or outlook, they get clipped pretty good. But yeah, no, I agree that the 3D is a very interesting way to go for that. You know, but what about is there any problem with, let's call, you know, the biotech? That's been on fire as well. I mean, there's a lot of acquisitions there, you know, that's going on in the whole biotech area as well. I know it's something you don't cover that much, but, you know, you see that. I mean, and I don't know if that's a precursor to the rest of the markets and what's happening, but kind of very interesting that you're seeing that as well.
Yeah, I mean, biotech is being fueled, people say, by momentum. You know, it's a momentum sector that's going up. And maybe a large cap, you see momentum. But there's a fundamental change going on with biotech companies where the amount of money coming off patents, and we've heard this story before, but if you look at the numbers, it's hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, you're looking at companies losing 60% of their revenue off of some drugs. But what have the large companies done? Because that's been a license to sell these large companies. But yet, these large companies, the advantage they have, the Pfizers, the Mercks, they know exactly when that patent, when their drug comes off patent. So they could adjust for it. Now, how do they adjust for it? Well, they manage to they generate a ton of cash flow. So they're giving more money back to their shareholders. They're increasing their dividend. They're buying back stocks. So that's held these names up. But what they're doing underlying, if you look at their balance sheets and you look within and listen to their conference calls, they're investing in a lot of early stage biotechs.
Mm-hmm.
If you pull up biotechs now, you know, they'll have a pipeline of 10 different drugs, and they'll have, you'll see Glaxo, this drug with Pfizer. You've never really saw that 5 years ago, where you're seeing that a lot, where, okay, they have $100 million. They'll take $100 million off their balance sheet and maybe invest $10 million in 10 of their favorite drugs, which is nothing, because if one of those happen to go to, you know, get the FDA approval and reach blockbuster status, you got a $1 billion drug on your hand. Mm-hmm. That's the growth model. So
right.
you know, take away the large caps, which are doing very well in biotech. The small caps, I think, have tremendous upside potential because they're getting funding from the biggest guys in a room. They're able to use their scientists, their technology, and help these drugs come along. Now, real quick, to invest in these, do not invest in companies that are going into phase 3 approval or going FDA approval, even phase 2 news. All these companies have difficulty approving. I think only like it's something like 5% of all drugs get approved by the FDA approval, even less than that, I believe. But you want to buy these stocks when they get destroyed because they always come up with bad news. Now, they'll come into FDA approval, whatever. It's a phase 2 study, and they'll say, you know, it came out negative. The stock will fall 60%. These stocks fall under cash value. You're getting their whole pipeline for free. And what people don't realize in biotech, some of these companies will say, well, you know, the study was so bad, we're getting rid of the drug. A lot of times they just want more information.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's a 6 month and 9 month, maybe a year process. But people hate to wait in this market. They hate it. So you're able to buy these. They come back up. And I mean, you can make 50, 60%. And then if they get approval, you'll make another 100, 200%. It's a formula that's worked for us to a T. I mean, you know, it's very hard to invest in these small biotech companies. But it's that formula of waiting for these companies to really get nailed and then jumping on them when they trade at cash value. You'll see it happen so much. It's two or three of them that get nailed every single day. Start doing your research and look at their pipeline, see who their partners are. Maybe they have Pfizer or Glaxo, and you could come up with like a 100-200% gain before you know it.
Yeah, no, it's been an amazing run on the big guys, also in the small guys. And I agree with you. The volatility on some of the small ones is astounding, you know, in terms of that. And I agree with you that they're still, unless they only have one drug and that drug is just, you know, canned. Then obviously there's a problem because then what else do they have? But if you have a company that is going through the process and does go into, you know, some kind of a final approval process and they have other ones behind them, they've been very much exciting. I'm not talking about the one and, you know, 50 cent or $1 companies. You know, I'm talking about the companies that at least have something that is either in use currently and they have another one they're trying to approve. Or like you said, you know, they have something that some of the big guys are coming off patent on that may be very interesting for the big guys to pick up, and that would obviously change the whole dynamic because now you have an incredible amount of sales and marketing ability from the company. You know, the distribution platform that's involved. You know, it's a whole, you know, amazing process that goes on from a small company just having, you know, an R&D is all they're doing. And then the next level is when it gets approval, and then you kind of have a company that buys them to just really expand it. So yeah, there's a lot of opportunity there. I definitely agree. So
absolutely.
We'll see. I mean, we'll see what happens with all this, and you know, with the fold in of Obamacare. But you know, just to kind of recap, I mean, the point here I think that you're making is that there's a lot of opportunity. You have buybacks that are going on. You have a lot of you know, hedge funds and we'll call it active investors that are involved in the market. You also have a lot of cash on the books, better balance sheets than we've had in a very long time because of the ability to refinance, restructure the debt. And on top of that, there are opportunities, yet it does possibly beg to be a little patient to find when those opportunities will come to you rather than just chase them. Is that a good summation?
Exactly. Remember that, you know, the Fed is providing this market for us, providing this opportunity. It's just a matter of you getting online and taking your money. It's up to you. If not, you know, you could have a safe investment. But the fact that, you know, maybe we see inflation in 2 years, maybe the Fed's wrong, but they're not expected to see inflation based on a CPI for 2017, which makes stocks a really good investment. They're going to continue to print money. That's why records are at all-time highs. This isn't, you know, 2000 or even 1987 or 86 when we're running up, or 2007 when we're running up, valuations got a little stretched. You know, looking at valuations, some of them are a little stretched, but when you look at Intel, IBM, ExxonMobil, it's still trading what, between 11 and 13 times earnings, yielding 2 to 5%. Those aren't really expensive.
And, yeah, especially when you get the dividend yield on those, and that's why you see the Dow has been doing so well, and the large cap, you know, dividends. I mean, companies have also gotten the idea that, hey, you know what, we can attract a lot more money if we have a dividend.
Exactly. I don't know if you have more time. I want to mention one more sector.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
All right. I really like, you know, I've visited all these, the oil patches, all the shale oil in the U.S., and people are under the impression that oil is going to come a lot lower. I don't think that's going to happen. I think you see oil prices elevated. I know you're seeing slowdown in areas, but if you look at Exxon, you look at Chevron, they're spending more money on CapEx than they've ever done, and their production numbers are going down. So, you know, Exxon's going up right now because it's a cheap stock. But what that means is they're paying a ton of money and they're not able to raise production. Well, that makes companies like Pioneer Natural Resources, Continental, who's a king in the Bakken, Pioneer is the king in the Permian Basin. Those are two of the biggest shale areas. Those companies, I believe, are going to become takeover targets. You could buy these companies for a lot cheaper than the billions and tens of billions of dollars that they're – I mean, they're spending $40 billion and not getting production results. You could spend the same amount of money, buy these guys, and they're growing production by like 10, 20, 30%. I think that's a good investment, especially now, because over the past couple of weeks, we've seen terrible weather across the whole, you know, Dallas, Texas, and even in the Bakken. They stopped drilling a lot of different areas, especially in Texas. And these stocks are down 15% from their highs. So I think it's a good buying opportunity to scale into some of these stocks. I think that shale oil plays are going to do very well. If you want a couple of names, again, Pioneer, Continental, also Laredo Petroleum, one of the biggest players. It's a small cap stock in the Permian Basin that's pulled back as well. They've drilled some of the biggest wells in the Permian Basin, which is going to be probably bigger than the Eagle Ford.
That's amazing. It's just amazing when you know, when we put our minds to something and we really have the – well, I don't know if we have the backing of the U.S. government or the government behind it, but at least we don't have the them stymieing it too much right now. You know,
Exactly, yes. So
that's great. The great Frank Curzio rounding out 2013 and into 2014 – my best to you and your family for a happy new year and for everything good for 2014, my friend.
You too. Thanks for having me on, man. I really appreciate it.
All right, buddy. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Take care. And our second guest, as we mentioned, we're going to talk about an interesting topic, is Ken Shea. He's a senior analyst, senior industry analyst for Bloomberg Industries. And Ken, how are you?
Good, thanks. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. I wanted to talk about this fascinating area of in the area of quote-unquote tobacco, which is the e-cigarettes, or the, I don't know how many names they go by, but, you know, what's going on in this area? And you've done a lot of research on this.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's probably the most important thing that's happened to the world of tobacco, at least in the U.S. anyway, in a number of years. As you said, e-cigarettes, are also known as, you know, vapors or vaporizers, have now grown pretty significantly over the last few years to about a $3 billion market. Here in the U.S., when you include online sales and other things. So it's moving along very fast, almost doubling in size over the last few years. And the reason for that is because a lot of smokers of traditional cigarettes are looking for options that are a little more, less harmful, more convenient, and there's also an advantage in terms of cost with electronic cigarettes.
You know, there's all these companies that were out there for a while, and I don't think anybody paid attention to them, you know, and then some of them all of a sudden started getting bought up, right? Blue was bought by Lorillard not too long ago.
That's right. Yeah, Lorillard has probably been the most aggressive in terms of getting into this area amongst the largest U.S. tobacco companies. Not too surprising because of their niche focus on menthol cigarettes. I mean, they're not quite as diversified by product line and geographics, for that matter, relative to Altria and Reynolds. So they got a jump start, really, on their bigger competitors by buying Blue e-cigs in April of earlier this year. And so they've been investing a lot of money behind that, and they're seeing very strong growth. They've already captured a near 50% retail market share, and signs are that franchise is going to continue to grow in 2014.
Now, is this going to be, was it done as a defensive move or was it done as an offensive move? And is this going to cannibalize on some of the things they do already?
Well, I think it's clearly a diversification move. I mean, volume continues to decline for traditional cigarettes as consumers are mindful of the, you know, harmful effects. There's more limited places where they can smoke and so on. So it's one, it's a defensive move, but also it's like I said, it's growing, you know, albeit at the expense of traditional cigarettes largely, but it's also tapping into a relatively new area, and that is the hope is anyway for the producers is that consumers can smoke these in places where traditional cigarettes can't be smoked, notwithstanding the New York City you know, ruling last week where they included e-cigarettes as part of their ban on cigarette smoking. But many other places around the nation, smokers can, in fact, vape where they can't smoke. So it's actually expanding the market in that sense.
Right, and then also I think there's a social change going on here because This is a water vapor, and the odor and the secondhand, quote-unquote, smoke is relatively not known in terms of really what the effects are. But a lot of these e-cigs, you can get them in any kind of level of nicotine that you want. So, you know, there's the ones that are prepackaged, which you just buy, let's say, at convenience stores or any stores which have, you know, they look like cigarettes. I think there's the E-Joy, there's the Blues. And they have nicotine in them, and so it is designed to have people be able to smoke in a more, I guess, a socially acceptable way that doesn't bother people around them. But there's also the others that have zero nicotine, and they have, quote-unquote, the flavored type of e-cig, or what do they call them, e-hookahs or something like that, right?
Yeah, that's right. There's a wide variety of the types of products, many that you mentioned. The most common, as you mentioned, are the disposable variety, where for an equivalent, basically two packs worth of puffs, you can have an e-cig that costs roughly about $8 or so. Once it's used up, it's, as it would imply, disposable. Another option is the refillable types, where you buy the vaporizer, but in addition to that, you can buy then the refillable liquids. And as you mentioned, they're flavored. Most of them contain nicotine, which is why the FDA is interested here. And in terms of the secondhand smoke, you're right in that it's largely an untested vapor that's being given off. Now, clearly, the majority of this, if not all of it, is water vapor. But there's also other elements in there that need, you know, in terms of the government, anyway, wants to take a look at and make sure that there's no ingredients that a secondhand smoker can be hurt by. So that's still up to the regulators to decide, you know, what that risk poses, if any. And that's why, at this early stage, I think a lot of municipalities are taking the safe route in saying, let's just treat it as at least a cigarette for now, while we investigate, you know, what the true harm may or may not be with these products.
And what's interesting is because you do have the flavored or the ones that are non-flavored, no nicotine. It's interesting because if there is, with a traditional cigarette, you have the smoke and you have the secondhand smoke and you have all the things that go on and the visual and the odor and then the potential harmful drugs or elements that go into your bloodstream as secondhand smoke I'm talking about, whereas the dissipation of these are much different, but you still don't know if there's going to be nicotine in it or not if you're sitting next to somebody. You have no idea. But I was wondering also about, is there a change in the age of the people that are using this? Because it seems from what I'm seeing, just, you know, what I look around and I see, that a lot of younger people are seeing this as something that's okay to do, where they've been taught that smoking is a bad thing and a terrible thing, and they were really kind of cutting down, and young people weren't picking up the habit as much. But now it seems that because you have these no nicotine versions, etc., it's much more socially acceptable.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, part of the reason the regulators are concerned here about this product is that in their view, anyway, it, quote, normalizes, unquote, cigarette smoking again. You know, the regulators or anti-tobacco group felt that in recent years it was kind of winning the tobacco wars, and that, you know, there's a reduction in smoking prevalence rates. There's a reduction in volumes, or that is, on consumption of cigarettes. And now comes along a product which could, in their view, bridge the gap, and that is, reduce the chances that someone who would otherwise may quit cigarettes altogether now has a viable option to maintain the habit of some sort and perhaps go back to traditional cigarette smoking. Mm. That's kind of a novel way of looking at the negatives, I think, of this product. I think, on the other hand, a lot of health advocates would say, you know, there's no harmful combustion, and that's really what harms cigarette smokers. It's the inhalation of carbon. It's not so much the it's not nicotine. Nicotine isn't the harmful element here. It's the carbons, and if the e-cig doesn't have those, then isn't this a good thing for society? The FDA is expected to weigh in on all this probably any day now, although they've been saying that for the last couple months at least, and they're going to, and their overarching goal is to control access to minors. you know, they and many interested parties here acknowledge that the majority, vast majority of cigarette smokers, traditional cigarette smokers, started before they were the age 18. So they're going to be looking at access to, you know, that age group to online sales, the way they're marketed at retail outlets, and flavorings, things like that, to try to minimize their access to minors.
Interesting. Now, just to get back to the size and scope of what's happening, we did some research and tried to find some publicly traded companies that were, quote-unquote, pure plays in the area of e-cigs. And we found, I don't know, I'll go and give you, you know, five maybe. But maybe only, really, we found one of them, maybe two, that were traded in a way that you could even invest in them. It's a company called Vapor Corp, VPCO, which is actually in my backyard. They're right here in, I don't know, they're probably 5 miles from where I'm located. And they have a pretty good selection, and they, you know, they sell, they manufacture, they sell. And what's interesting is that there really isn't a lot of pure plays. They've, like, you know, the ones that, I think eJoy is a private, and that is, what's his name? The guy that helped start Facebook, the guy that did Sean, what is his name? The guy, the Napster guy, you know?
Yeah, I don't mean, I can't think of
anyway, he's got a big investment in that company. They look like cigarettes. They kind of, they have the whole look and feel of all of it. But this entire industry, you recently changed your outlook from a 50% year-over-year growth to, you upped it to 100% growth over the next, what is it, 4 years? 100% every year for 4 years?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, trying to predict where this industry is going to go, it's hard right now. You know, it's completely in the hyper-growth stage. Because you've got to remember, even if they're generating $2 or $3 billion in sales, it's still a fraction of the $90 billion in U.S. cigarette sales currently, and some $800 billion globally. So it's still somewhat of a drop in a bucket. And that's why these growth rates are hard to predict as they, you know, encroach more and steal more share from traditional cigarettes. One back-of-the-envelope way that we looked at it is, you know, maybe this industry can, in fact, you know, double in size from its relatively small base over the next few years. Now, that's subject to change, given first how the year 2013 comes in, but also, more importantly, how the FDA weighs in on things in terms of some of the rules they may impose. Clearly, online sales is a big portion of sales. If that's banned or severely restricted in the U.S. somehow, that's going to weigh on, you know, access. If it's going to be tougher to get access for folks who need an ID, I mean, that's going to reduce. If they reduce flavorings to levels or to choices that are less, you know, attractive, that could weigh on sales. So there's a lot of wild cards here that's going to dictate, you know, how fast this industry grows.
It's fascinating because, you know, now we're in the potential change of mentality of, you know, if someone was to give a gift to somebody of a carton of cigarettes, it would be just absolutely just horrifying. You know, now all of a sudden you give somebody, I guess, what do they call it, a vaporizer or something, a vapor or something or other. You know, you give that as a gift. I mean, it's almost like, oh, hey, thanks for the new technology in smoking. And it's just a fascinating market. I don't know of any other really that has opened up like this and is potentially there to change the landscape of something. I mean, how long have we had cigarettes around? I mean, they've been around forever, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, amazing.
It really is. I mean, it really is a transformative event in the tobacco industry, and there really hasn't been anything like this in many, many years. I can't think of a precedent like this where it is could be a virtual substitute for the product. Now, I think the manufacturers, the producers of these cigs would even concede that the technology is at a relatively early stage. I think everyone would think that the technology should be able to improve and have an experience for the user to be more cigarette-like. But the conundrum is, how do you do that with, you know, not offending the person that's sitting next to you? How do you do that to convince regulators that there's not going to be a harmful after effect, that there's not going to be harm caused by minor? You know, all those things are going to play into that. But clearly, you know, users like what they see so far, and so I would think that this is going to be an industry that's going to grow for some time.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, look for acquisition targets, look for companies to get more involved in it, look for, you know, the potential for. I would say that, you know, the place that we're looking at is Lorillard. Frankly, we bought a position in that, and this vapor company. Again, it is all dependent on what the FDA says and the rules and all that. But considering the fact that they are all, there's many of them without nicotine, you could say that the potential at least is for an industry to have some growth that is still considerable. And even if there are some FDA regulations on it, it still is a reasonable alternative to cigarettes for the many people that even smoke now that are looking to cut back and find a healthier alternative if they have to, you know, if it's necessary.
That's right, because as many experts would say that a lot of cigarette smoking is the it's the ritual that they go through, you know, the oral fixation and the having something in their hand while they're, you know, conversing and all this, and that's a substitute product regardless of the, you know, the substitutable flavor and so on, then I think it's going to satisfy the experience to some degree.
Very interesting. Very, very fascinating. Hey, I appreciate your input, Ken Shea from Bloomberg, telling us a little bit about what's going on here, and we'll keep a watch on your research and all that. Really great stuff. Thanks.
Thank you, Andrew. All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Well, as they say in the business, that's a wrap. And we're going to end right there on a good note, and hopefully we are going to continue providing the same level of quality guests and research and information for you. Hopefully you've learned a lot from the show. I always learn so much from listening to our guests. And again, if you have any questions, please feel free to send me a note. Ask Andrew at The Disciplined Investor. Definitely for 2014, make sure that I am on your Twitter feed. It's at Andrew Horowitz, one word. And you'll get all the information that we're putting out, like the podcast and different notes that we put out. You'll get it first. Thanks for joining me. Stick around. You'll hear that great addition after we have that announcer telling all the little disclaimers. I'll see you next year. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.
Should all acquaintance be forgot and never brought to should all acquaintance be forgot and all lang syne? For auld lang syne, my dear, for auld lang syne, we'll take a cup of kindness yet for the days he's fine. from morning sun to night, but the seas between us broad have roared from for all land.